The hour comes for our return to Earth. And as we blast off into the stillness of the spatial seas, we try to understand something of what we have seen.
Look up, look up, look up, beyond the flaming sun. There's light enough that's bright enough to kindle faith in everyone. Look up, look up, look up, and find the falling star, the hand divine that made it shine, reminds us just how small.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. This is UBC Happy Hour, a show that is all about what is happening at UBC. This show is collaboratively produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. If you like what you hear and you want to help make this show, send us an email at ubcaffairs@citr.ca. I'm Lelaine.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Alex Lenz. I'm the coordinator for the collective. And we have a really special episode today. So Lelaine, do you want to kind of give a rundown of what's happening?
Yeah, we are very proud to present this week's episode, which is focused on women's issues and how some of these issues are being discussed and addressed here at UBC. The theme of today's show is in anticipation of tomorrow's Women's March On, an event taking place tomorrow at the Jack Poole Plaza in downtown Vancouver.
Yeah, so we have a really packed episode this week. So we're just going to dive right into it with our first guest. So we're joined live today by Dr. Marina Adshade. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here. So Dr. Marina Adshade is an economics professor here at UBC, and her research focuses on the economics of love and sex. She's the author of numerous books, including The Love Market, What You Need to Know About How We Date, Mate, and Marry. And so she's joining us today to discuss two of her op-eds, which have recently appeared in the Globe and Mail. So yeah, congratulations on those.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, so thank you so much for joining us today. And could you maybe start off by introducing yourself and which courses you teach at UBC? Maybe some of your students are listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I am a professor in the Vancouver School of Economics, as you said, and I teach only two courses at the moment, but the one of the courses that maybe is of interest to your listeners is that I teach Women in the Economy, which is it's a pretty popular course because we talk about a lot of the topics that I talk in my book. In fact, my students use the book. We talk about marriage and we talk about fertility and we talk about women in the workforce. So really, many of the topics you'll probably be talking about in today's show.
Awesome. So let's start with your op-ed that was published last week in the Globe and Mail, and it was titled "Governments Should Fund Birth Control as They Do HIV Prevention." So what are the main economic reasons why governments should fund birth control?
Yeah, so I was inspired to write this article because I already knew in the fall that the BC government was gearing up to fund the HIV prevention drug PrEP. I don't know if your listeners know how much you know about PrEP, but PrEP is a drug that you can take every day, and if you take it, it is virtually impossible to contract HIV. So it's an important drug, especially in a city like ours, where we do have many people with HIV. But it's an expensive drug. And so when I first heard that they were going to fund it, my first thoughts were, yes, absolutely. Funding PrEP makes absolute sense for this province. At the same time, however, women in this province have been waiting forever for governments to fund birth control. The province's argument for funding PrEP is that it saves them money in the long run, even though it's an expensive drug. The amount that they save by funding a drug like PrEP is tiny compared to the amount of money that they would save if they funded birth control. There's a report that came out in 2010 that said that if the province of British Columbia funded birth control, it would save $42 million a year. And that's just on very basic things like medical care. So the math doesn't add up. Economically, the right thing to do is to fund birth control. If you even forget about the moral issues around, you know, how much hardship is caused by women and children when they have unplanned pregnancies and births, economically, it's a smart thing to do.
What do you think is kind of preventing from governments from taking that step towards covering it? Do you think it's kind of like a taboo subject, or why do you think they're not funding it?
No, I think that once they fund a drug that is used predominantly by gay men, they cannot claim that this is a taboo subject, right?
Very true.
But I have an answer for this question. And the answer to the question is the reason why they fund PrEP and they don't fund contraceptives is that there are champions for PrEP. There is, you know, BC Center for Excellence that studies HIV and AIDS that has been lobbying the government for this change. When it comes to women's issues, many women's issues, and the issue of contraceptives, we just don't have any champions in this province. And this is really what we need. We need people to take up the cause. And if I can just say, as a starting off place for it, when I first heard about PrEP and I've had my first views on contraceptives, the very first thing I did was pick up the phone and called my local MLA. You know, you have a representative in government who is there every day making decisions. The local representative of government, for anybody who lives on BC campus, is David Eby. You can phone his office. You can make an appointment to go see him. You can sit in front of him and say, why is the province not funding contraceptives? And I think that that's what we need. That's the only thing that will really make any change here, because this is not on the government's agenda. It's not like our government is sitting in Victoria saying, maybe we should fund this. They're not. And that's because nobody's really pushing for it.
So that leads to another question, which is the Women's March On is happening tomorrow in Vancouver. And do you think that kind of mass movements like that might have some kind of impact on this policy? Or
I think it's important that people go out and protest. But I don't think that's sufficient, right? I think that when women in Vancouver go out and protest for the Women's March, all of our politicians sit there and say, absolutely, 100% agree. It's time things that change. But they need very specific changes that they can make. It's not just, this is not a cultural change. This is a policy decision. And so if it inspires people to organize, then absolutely it should make a difference. But it's not just enough to go out once a year, you know, down to downtown Vancouver and carry a sign. We need more than that. We need organization.
Yeah, so somewhere that, you know, we can look to kind of an example might be Ontario. So Kathleen Wynne's Liberal government announced in their budget that 4,400 types of prescription drugs, including birth control, would be fully covered for Ontario residents who are under the age of 25. So there are definitely limits to this. And the policy is coming into effect this month. So this, to me, seems like a step forward in the right direction, although it's not kind of focused specifically on birth control. But I guess, you know, this is kind of an example of one place that's starting to do this. But do you, I guess, yeah, what do you think about, like, that decision of the Ontario government? And do you think that the province of BC could kind of implement a similar policy?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, first of all, I would like to see for all drugs. The under 25 thing is fine, but this is not just a problem that affects women who are under the age of 25. This is a problem that affects all women. And you know what, it's not just Ontario. I think that Canadians would be very surprised to find out how much we are falling behind other places. We are the only country in the world that has socialized medicine that doesn't pay for at least some level of birth control. The only one. And then there's many, many U.S. states that are ahead of us. For example, states that we don't even think of as being particularly progressive. In Virginia, all birth control is covered for all women. In Florida, all birth control is covered for all women. Colorado, these are Republican states, all birth control is covered for all women. So why is British Columbia, where we think ourselves socially so progressive, why is this not even being discussed? This is a great question. And Ontario, by the way, is ahead of us on a variety of different dimensions. I think that we know that now, right? We've seen that with the minimum wage increases. We've seen that with their programs for the minimum income programs that they're testing out. Ontario is moving into the position of being the most progressive province in the country.
Very well said. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're going to switch over to your most recent op-ed in the Globe and Mail, which was just published today, this morning. So it's hot off the press. And it's titled, When It Comes to Sex, Women Are More Than Just Gatekeepers. So this piece discusses notions of consent and as they relate to the story of actor and comedian Aziz Ansari, which has been a story that's been all over the media recently. So you discussed the gatekeeper model of consent. So could you explain this idea and how it relates to the story of Aziz Ansari?
Yeah, so it'll actually be hot off the press tomorrow because it's in online today, but it's going to be in tomorrow's paper, which is exciting for me because I really think I'm just going to cut it out and put it on my door in the economics department at UBC because you'll be unsurprised to learn that people in the economics department don't have a lot of conversations about these topics, which is too bad because there's actually a very serious economic story here, and that is that throughout most of human history, women have exchanged sex for other things. They exchanged sex for the security of marriage, for a home, for all of those things, for income. And this idea that women exchange sex for other things, where men just have sex for pleasure, is so deeply ingrained in our culture that I don't even think we are aware that it's there. And so what that has given us is this model of sex where men initiate sex and women say yes or no. And then what happens after that is independent of female pleasure. It's because she's already said yes, presumably she's getting the transaction of whatever it is that she wanted. It's all for his pleasure. There's none of this like idea of ongoing consent, right? And that's what the gateway is. It would be like saying once you open the door and let somebody into your house that they can do anything they want when they're there. We would never believe that's true. But when it comes to female sexuality, this is very much the perspective. And a lot of the online discussion that we're seeing looks very much like that. Even from women who are saying, oh, well, she just wanted to be his girlfriend and now she's disappointed. The idea is that the reason why she had sex with him is because she thought she was going to get something in return, the opportunity to be a celebrity's girlfriend, not that she maybe possibly just wanted to have sex with him because she thought that that would be a fun thing to do.
Yeah, it was interesting because when I read the first paragraph of your article, the first thing I thought of was this kind of story from when I was in, I think, grade 11 or grade 12. So, yeah, teenager. And I overheard a guy in my class say a good key will open many locks, but a good lock will only open for one key, which was a reference to, you know, sex and women as the locks and men as the keys. And that was only, you know, I don't know, 6 years ago or something. And that's so it really resonated with me. Yeah. So this is definitely like a really, I think, common narrative. And definitely, I think, touches on the fact that like the narrative of, you know, if women kind of seek sex, they're portrayed as sluts, whereas men seeking sex is viewed as like natural and encouraged. And yeah, so this was a really interesting piece to me. So you kind of touch on how sexual pleasure relating to consent is kind of maybe evolving. So, yeah, how does that relate to how does kind of sexual pleasure within the narrative of consent, how is that related to women's economic positions?
Yeah, I think so. We have the no means no model of consent right now, which feminists have fought very hard for good reasons. But it's still based on the gateway model, the idea that once you say yes, then you've just let somebody in, right? We do need a new model, and there are new models coming up. There's the idea of enthusiastic consent, which is an ongoing consent. I really don't think that enthusiastic consent is the end of the story, though, because even enthusiastic consent requires a woman to constantly say yes, right? Whereas, you know, and this is one of the things that came up in the Ansari articles, the idea that you're using nonverbal cues. You know, people are like, oh, nonverbal cues. He's not a mind reader. But honestly, anybody who reads the article would know that there's absolutely no way he thought she was having a good time. He just couldn't have. I mean, if they like to use the analogy is if you had somebody over for dinner and they really disliked your food, would they have to tell you? How long would it take before you figured out that what they were eating was unpleasant? And then would you sit there and expect them to finish their meal? You wouldn't. You'd say, do you not like the dinner? And can I give you something else? I don't know why within sexuality we wouldn't have the same thing. And I don't see that women have to constantly say yes, yes, yes. Men, and of course we're talking about heterosexual relationships because to be perfectly honest, in same-sex relationships between women, and maybe your readers can give more insight on it, but when we look at papers and stuff that have been written on this, this is not actually a problem, right? There is ongoing consent. You know, I don't think that it's a lot to ask for men to pay attention to the nonverbal cues, to say, well, as long as she's not saying, I can keep doing what I want. And so that is the model of consent we need. The model that I'm thinking about is something more of like interrational, where I observe how my behavior affects you. You observe how your behavior affects me, and everybody changes their behavior accordingly. That would be ideal. Of course, we still need no means no. That's not like something we're going to put out in the trash, but we need something better so that your generation can have better sex, because your generation should have better sex. There's no reason for you not to ask for it. You should not be listening to any of the older generation who says, oh, this is what sex is like. No, it doesn't have to be like this. It should be, and it can be better.
Amen.
That was a great analogy.
Yeah.
I like that.
Wow. I'm so intrigued, and now I'm so inspired as well. So thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, can I just say one more thing?
Yeah.
So my article is coming out, is in the Globe right now. So your readers should read it. I'd love to hear any feedback. I'm on Twitter. It's just at Marina Adshade. But I also have a TED Talk. The title of my TED Talk is Your Mother's Not a Whore. Which is on this same topic, and I think that might be interesting to your listeners as well.
Awesome. I was just watching one of your TED Talks before, and I was on sexual freedom, and I was feeling also very inspired. So, yeah.
Great. And, well, anybody had any feedback for me, I'd love to hear it.
Awesome. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I really, I just really appreciate, like, I've been reading a lot of articles about, like, some people from, like, the older generations being, like, telling us, like, younger generations, like, well, that's the way it was. So it's, like, really, like, meaningful to have an older generation. Sorry not to call you old.
No, I'm actually happy to wear this flag today, because mm-hmm. I've also been hearing this all day. Mm-hmm. A number of people who are commenting on it saying, well, the older feminists don't get it, but Marina Adshade understands. I'm like, okay, older feminist over here, but, yeah, that's totally fine.
Yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm happy. I'm happy that I'm actually just, it's such a privilege to be able to have a voice and to be able to use it in this opportunity, because I think this is an important discussion to be having.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we're kind of continuing on with the theme of powerful, strong women. And Amy sat down with two actors from a play that focuses on kind of female strength. So do you want to introduce your interview?
Yeah, so just recently I interviewed Jed Weiss and Olivia Lang of the UBC play She Kills Monsters. It's a really unique, nerdy, feminist play about a woman, Agnes, who is learning to deal with her grief at her sister's death by playing as her sister in Dungeons & Dragons. So take a listen.
Hi, everyone. This is Amy Shandro for CITR on the UBC Happy Hour. I have today with me Jed Weiss and Olivia Lang from the upcoming UBC show, She Kills Monsters. Hi, guys.
Hey.
So tell me a bit about the show. Just give a brief synopsis for anyone listening out there.
Well, it's a show about Agnes Evans, who is a teacher, a high school teacher, who loses her family very tragically in a car accident, including her little sister, Tilly. And when in the process of cleaning out their family house, she finds this Dungeons & Dragons module that her little sister has written, and she goes and plays this game in kind of a process of grieving her family and her sister.
Awesome. That sounds... I really like this play. It's really unique, and... I've never heard of a play like this. So what was it like working on such a unique play? Obviously, there's a lot of different components to it that you wouldn't get with, if you guys worked on like Wives and Daughters, that's completely different.
Well, I think it's really the same thing. 1995 Dungeons and Dragons play, an 1800s period piece.
Yeah.
Everything's the same, but no, it's completely different from what we've done. And it was, I think, number one, the first interesting bit about it, just hearing the synopsis, is definitely the fact that you really have to balance the real tragedy of the backstory of it, while at the same time it's a very joke heavy and really comedic fun piece. So that was definitely an interesting balance. And then also, it's probably the most choreographed anything that I've seen in a play that is non-musical. Like, the amount of fights, we are phenomenal. Fight organizers Ryan and Kovac have said this is like probably the most fight heavy play that they've ever done, and they've had a lot of experience in the field. So it's there's a lot you have to juggle with it, but it's really, really fun.
Mm-hmm. How was learning all that fight choreography? And you're the co-fight captain person.
me and the illustrious Shona Struthers are the co-fight captains. It's funny because of the 13-person cast, including Olivia over here, 12 out of the 13 folks are all involved with fights. I'm the only one that isn't. So it Shona was made like the one of the in-fight captains, mostly because she has more experience in the field. And then for me, the great process of elimination of the other captain, simply because I always had an outside eye looking into it. So that was really interesting, seeing that I had pretty limited fight experience, except for this last year, what we got to learn in the acting program through some of the classes. But from that, I kind of retained more of an audience eye for it, just to see what was working, what didn't, and then basically then had talks with Shona to delineate what needed to be changed and what needs to be altered for the fights.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people fighting are women, which you don't really see often in play. So how was that for you, Olivia?
It was so awesome. Like every time we do this show, I'm just struck by like the number of women on stage, and that my character is part of the core adventuring party, mm-hmm. which is four women and one demon who's a man. just to have the opportunity to fight at this level and fight after fight after fight, like women fighting women, women fighting men. Basically, ultimately, women fighting monsters, has been so empowering and just an amazing experience. And like going through the rehearsal process and seeing everyone grow and change and get stronger, because we were like fighting half days of rehearsal and then we do blocking. Mm-hmm. And seeing everyone grow and change and just like, you know, kick butt and take names.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm sure you guys got like really fit.
Yeah.
And you mentioned fighting monsters. So there's a lot of, I guess, puppetry and different ways, because you guys have to actually fight like monsters and represent on stage. So how is it working with, I understand that puppetry is pretty new to UBC, and like UBC Theater hasn't done a show of this scale with like the special effects that way. So what was that like for you guys?
Well, I know, Jed, you do with shadow puppets. I don't know if this is a spoiler, but I end up puppeting one of a very large dragon puppet. Come to see the show if you want to know more. definitely working with the puppets and working with fight choreography and puppets was a challenge, and I know for our fight directors it was an interesting process, because it adds a whole other element when you're not, you know, a human or, in my case, an elf fighting. You're a dragon, or you're a kobold, or any of these fantastical characters. And so it was really interesting. And we have like amazing puppets in the show by our amazing puppet designer Nicolette. And it was super, super awesome. I don't know how you feel about the shadow puppets.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's an awesome like thing. It's. I still find it really like surprising that we could stuff as many mediums of like any type of storytelling that we do into it without it seeming really jumbled. But it actually comes across very like a cohesive, good story. But we involve like a shadow puppet scene in the beginning. There's some like Olivia was hinting at some spoiler-free details, but a large puppet that is dangerous looking is in it, and. Then also there's, with the fight, with the mask work for folks that are just fighting as different monsters that without any puppetry. So there's all these different, like, styles of telling this, like, a fantasy story that really work well together. So it's, and the one thing that I really liked about it, too, is just the expected competence that the directors had in us, as opposed to worrying about, in like, a professional world, of course, like, naturally you're going to hire people that have, like, experience with puppets and all this kind of stuff, but with this, partly because limited resources, but mostly because just there was a real trust that we could pick up these new skills very quickly, and I think it really paid off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really neat. So you mentioned that like the fight choreography, how you'd partly learn in the BFA program, like as part of your classes. Was there any other like weird connections that you made? Where you're like, wow, I learned this in class. I didn't know that I could like connect this to the really unique circumstances of this play?
Well, being in the Telus Theater at the Chan Center is definitely a very interesting vocal space for actors. Our voice teacher compared it to being in a school gymnasium because it has this resonance and this echoey space because I believe it was originally built to be more of a concert hall than to be a theater for actors to perform in. And so definitely going through and making sure everything is very clear and that the story can be heard, and we're all very much on our diction so that every word is super, super clear. And yeah, just getting in the space beforehand and having classes in there and really sorting out kind of what that vocal space sounds like so that the audience can get that story as clearly as possible.
Nice. Yeah, that's really interesting because most of, I don't know if this is true, but are most of your plays in the Freddie Wood, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, really different space to play in, which is really neat.
Yeah, it's been fun.
And I understand, I read this in the UBC article, that you guys actually played a game of Dungeons & Dragons before you got into it.
Yeah, we did.
How was that? I'm interested.
Well, I never played D&D before, mm-hmm. and... like, being an actor, I was like, yeah, role play, this is going to be awesome. Mm-hmm. And it took me about probably 45 minutes of being like, okay, this is my character sheet, like having to really think about it cerebrally. And then you just totally become immersed in the story. And I know the people I was playing with also said the same, that they stopped picturing, like, the table in front of us, and they actually started picturing what the campaign was and what the world we were living in was and our characters, and we started getting more creative with how we were playing versus just, playing how we thought we should be playing. And so mm-hmm. that was really fun, and I think a really great gateway into this world because we're inviting the audience to come on that adventure with us, and I mm-hmm. think they go through a certain warm-up period as well. And last night we had our preview. I really enjoyed. There's a couple moments where I can kind of, like, through the cracks of the curtains, see the audience reaction. And I definitely felt that sense that we're all going on the quest as performers and as well as the actors. And I definitely feel like the play captures that sense of the game and that it's a communal quest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, what I really liked about it, too, is I started just playing briefly Dungeons & Dragons with my roommate and one of my good friends, Braden, and he introduced me and my other friend, Olivia, to, like, Dungeons & Dragons, and we started playing over the summer. And there is this element that it reminded me a lot of when in 10th grade that I ended up doing my first musical, actually, because there's, mm-hmm. for both times, well, there's, like, the role-playing in this universe that there's the stigma against the nerdiness, or you're in a musical and there's kind of, like, the high school stigma against the theater geek. When the first beginning of it, it feels like, oh, this is dumb. I'm just going to, like, mess around. I'm not going to take it seriously. But then as time goes by, you realize the more you buy into it, it just becomes better and more fun. And because of that, it's like, I find it really the same thing with a lot of acting, where it's like, once you actually buy into the escapism of it, it becomes infinitely more fun. So that's why it's really awesome to see, like, stigmas against it, like, disappearing, people all over the world and, like, different groups that usually probably wouldn't even be interested in these type of role-playing games are really, like, hopping into it. So that's been really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the audience, like, feels the same way once you're in that universe for, like, a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, so you're saying that, this show is really, it's really unique, and it's been labeled as a geek theater, and it might drive some people away, but you think that it kind of, like, it almost goes on a beginner's, like, D&D journey with the audience. Mm-hmm. And so, like, yeah, what else do you think that this show could, like, offer to people who are maybe reluctant, being like, I don't know, because it's just, like, it's so different. It might be, like, mm-hmm. not going to say that your show isn't worth watching. I'm so excited for it. I'm really pumped to see it, but, yeah.
It has nothing to offer. No, it has so much to offer. No, well, that's the thing, too. It's, like, it's... what I really like about the universe of this show especially is that it is going to be proud of its eccentricities whether you like it or not. So you could fight it the whole time and just be bummed out by it, or just let yourself, like, fall into it, and, like I was saying, you'll have an infinitely better time with it. And I think it's so grounded in reality and the storytelling of it that no matter what, like, it will still feel real. That's the really cool thing about the way it's set up, is that it oscillates between the real 1995 world it's in Ohio, and then this fantastical, like, the fantasy world it is. And of course, you know, you're playing Dungeons & Dragons, just a few people around a table. That's all it is in physically. But what it's meant to create is the actual mental feeling you get when you're that immersed in a game where you have these infinite possibilities. And I think it's that experience is going to be synonymous with an audience member that even is reluctant at first. You just get blown away by, like, the special effects and how much work is put into it that it stops mattering, I think.
Definitely. And I think at the core of it, it's a story about two sisters and, and you know, that they're going out and they're fighting both monsters in the game, and Agnes herself is fighting the monsters of her grief over her family. And so I think what truly underpins, you know, regardless of the geekiness, and which is, you know, so fun if you know that that culture or that world, but it's underpinned by this very human story that I think all of us can relate to. And plus, you get to see some really badass women, some really badass monsters, which in itself, if you know D&D or not, is really, really fun.
Yeah, I'm really excited for the show. I think it's going to be really great. So it's opening tonight, Thursday, which will be yesterday when this airs. And what's the runtime for this show?
It runs until February 3rd.
February 3rd. Great. Cool. And it's in the Telus Theater in Chan Center.
Yep.
Cool. Well, thank you guys for coming. I really enjoyed this interview. This was really cool. And I literally can't express how excited I am to see this. So break a leg out there tonight, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello, we are UBC Dance Club, one of the largest and oldest clubs on campus.
We offer classes taught by professionals for complete beginners in Latin and standard ballroom dancing.
Come check us out and learn how to wow your friends, meet new people, and dance the stress from classes away.
Check out our website, www.ubcdanceclub.com, and find us on Facebook at UBC Dance Club.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hello, we are in studio with the Catherine Room today. Could you give yourself a brief introduction of what you do and, yes, please.
Thanks, Julia. Okay, so I'm the president and CEO of an organization called Technical Safety BC, and we are responsible for safety system oversight of all technical equipment in the province. So basically, we look after ski lifts and elevators and electrical and gas systems and boilers and ice rinks and amusement devices and railways. So a very broad group of things that can explode or burn, and we are there to make sure it doesn't happen.
Wow, so you're very related to public activity.
Exactly, yeah, we're in the space of protecting the public, wow. Public safety. Yeah,
that's wonderful. That's a lot of great responsibility. I guess bringing that into what is going to happen on January 20th with the Women's March, being a woman in such a position, how does that play into part? Do you feel conscious of that, or is it just?
You know, something? I have this feeling around where we are at this point in time in the world that it's actually finally occurred to people that you need complete diversity of helping solve the world's most intractable problems. So that's what I feel like every day that I go to work. How can I get as many opinions and this sort of rich discussion about what do we do to solve really difficult, crunchy technical problems? And women form a part of that. Every diversity forms a part of that. And yeah, it just sort of feels like the world's woken up to that. I hope so. Mm-hmm. It better have.
Yeah, definitely. And in the light of all that is going on with people trying to bring equality into the situation, I guess you would hope that the attitude has changed. But do you feel like there is a shift in attitude, or do you feel sometimes that you are othered or ostracized?
Well, I graduated from school in 1990, so that's a long time ago. And when I first came into industry, in some ways, I used it to my advantage that I would be the only woman engineer in a room. So there's a way of drawing attention to your ideas by, you know, being the only. And yes, it was difficult at times. And at the same time, I think part of that, I actually turned that to my advantage. I think for young women getting into those kinds of careers, for anybody who maybe doesn't look like everybody else who's around them, in some respects, it's quite a bit harder because there's this view the world has changed that, you know, it's all fixed. I had a niece tell me, she's 11, oh yeah, well, it's all good now, right? And I just, you know, so much has changed for the positive, and yet in some respects, women of your generation, it's that much harder because there's a view, well, it shouldn't be so difficult for you. In fact, I think you just have different issues and problems to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. And some of those perhaps is when women are coming into the office, then there might be tensions between male and female roles. And I recently with the Me Too, you see that there's a lot of office spaces where sexual assault has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that for one of your meetings, you had to bring that up. What was some things that you discussed about in that meeting?
I have zero tolerance for people making other people feel small. And we have this amazing culture at Technical Safety BC, and we talk about these issues. So once a quarter, we do a town hall with all 400 employees by video and conference call. And at the end of that, my colleague and I, she was hosting the town hall, we brought up the issue of Me Too and the issue you've seen a lot in the news recently of these terrible incidents that are happening around racial profiling and just like ugly, ugly incidents. And it opened up for us a discussion in the organization. It was really time to start listening to people that maybe have experienced that in their past. I mean, maybe experience it today in my organization, I hope not, but that we begin to actually deeply listen, to step back and let people talk about what has gone on for them. And I think that is the first place we need to go.
Mm-hmm. So for people looking for those safe spaces, what would be some suggestions, I guess, if they were to experience those kinds of things? What did you suggest to your employees, for example?
I think that many organizations now, UBC would not be any different, have resources available, and those are the employee and family assistance programs that organizations run, counseling that's available. And I think that often we feel alone in situations, and what I would just say is, you know, there's so many people that are out there who want to support you and to make those resources, you know, work for you. But also just to realize that you're not alone in this. And, you know, women like you and I, we want to make sure we're reaching out a hand to support whoever needs that help.
Mm-hmm. And most definitely, UBC has a sexual assault AMS, office that you can
go to
to come out and ask for help, which is really important. Reaching out, really, isn't it? I guess moving away from what's going on with the sexual assault. I mean, there are also, I feel as a woman also in the STEM, that sometimes there is a moment of belittling, and I feel like it's something that's really difficult to deal with. Do you have any advice for some of the young engineers and scientists in UBC mm-hmm. for dealing with those situations?
Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes things happen and then it kind of goes past. The moment goes past in time and you're like, wait a minute, did that really just happen? So for me, an example, I was out with one of our employees, a technical employee, probably about half a year ago, and we went to do an assessment of this big electrical site. And he introduced me to the electrician who was our client on the site. And he introduced me as the CEO. He said, you know, I'm with my boss. And the guy said, oh, nice to meet you. And my employee felt the need to say, don't worry, she gets lots of help. So he was contextualizing for, you know, his client that, yeah, I may have a woman who's a boss, but, you know, things are still fine. We still run the company. And I think he did it completely unconsciously. But, you know, that moment goes past and you're like, wait a minute, that really just happened? I've been the CEO for 6 years here. Mm-hmm. And they kind of pile up, right? People often talk about those kinds of things as like drowning in feathers. So one incident, okay, yeah, I can let that roll off my back. But, you know, it's you know, 50 a week, or, you know, it's how somebody sort of says, oh, hey, you look tired today, right, as the start of kind of just doing a little bit of power shift in the interaction. I think the important thing is to recognize that they're happening and then to give yourself space to deal with it, right? Give yourself a break. These are not easy things to deal with when they happen in the moment. And just get in the habit of just stepping back and realizing, yeah, that was something I don't have to let go. And then stepping into your power and, hey, you know what just happened here? I'd like to tell you how that made me feel. And just once you kind of get into that, you know, a little bit of recognition and then, yep, I'm going to bring my power to that and I'm going to not let that go by. Mm-hmm. And you're doing that so it doesn't happen to the next person.
Yeah. So we're kind of supporting each other. In
totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
That is really awesome. And I guess that can give you a little bit of courage as well to think that for the woman in the future, this is something that you're helping them out with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, that's really amazing.
I mean, we're on this planet together, right? And it's so empowering to kind of know you're with a group of people that, you know, we've experienced this stuff. Yeah, I mean, the two of us probably both have, and so we're colleagues and we're sisters in that, and there's ways of dealing with it. That's the thing. Mm-hmm.
And I guess that could even extend beyond just the sisterhood, but even to, I mean, right now we're having our Pride Week, so thinking if there's some minority that is having difficulty dealing with something, it's also easy to come in and support and defend it. Or
absolutely, absolutely. It's the broader community, right? We are all of this planet, mm-hmm. and we're all amazing and powerful, so... Yeah, supporting one another.
Who are some people that inspire you to be so tough? And
I have to say, I'm just always inspired by the people I meet who are like just at the beginning of their careers. So, you know, the fact that you're doing physics and then you're also in international relations, Julia, that but you're putting two things together that is just so amazing. I mean, the reason that you and I met at that Women in Engineering seminar the other night is my daughter is in that group. So okay. She's about to graduate from engineering. And I feel like my job is to push up. And yeah. You get to this point in your career, there's a reason why I had all of this luck and now I have this opportunity to use the power for something great.
Wow. It seems like a lot of responsibility, though. Like, wow, I don't know. Okay. And there is one thing that you mentioned at this Women in Engineering conference that really stuck with me. I think you were speaking of Jonah Berger, the Invisible Influence.
Oh, yes. Was this book, The Shadow Negotiation, that I talked about.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think you could elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
That?
I think this is a really interesting resource, and we're all kind of looking for, okay, what are the things that are going to give me something to say in the moment? And also to recognize when something's going on and it's actually not giving me power, it's taking my power away. The Shadow Negotiation is such an amazing book. It's a really, really good reference, I think, because it puts in context that every social interaction that we have is a negotiation. Often it's a negotiation just for a relationship and affiliation, but there are times when it's a negotiation for something that is of value to one or the other people. Mm-hmm. And when the negotiation is fair, both people are understanding what is the conscious discussion, but that, of course, there's all of this emotional discussion, often unconscious. What I have seen over my career is that some people really learn how to do that negotiation consciously or unconsciously better than other people. And I do think that in general, it's a terrible generalization, but I do think that men are socialized in that negotiation around, you know, the subconscious, I'm going to create a power dynamic in order to get what I need out of this discussion. So an example for me would be pretty early on in my career, I was kind of a mid-level engineer, project manager, had this big thing that I had to run. And I had just finished reading The Shadow Negotiation, had been recommended to me. And in it, it had described what happens when someone uses emotion to derail the conversation that's actually about something quite objective, some issue. And I ended up in a conversation with someone who is a vice president, so really senior to me, quite powerful. And he asked me to come into his office, and he closed the door, and he started yelling at me. Terrible, right? Like, you know, it's completely inappropriate at work. Very emotionally charged. Something had really, really upset him. And, you know, my heart's pounding now even thinking about it, because we have these sort of physical memories of, you know, when someone makes you feel small. And I remember a line in the book, which was, it's really powerful when you say to somebody, you know what, let's not talk about me. Let's talk about the issue. So I said it out loud. I actually had to take a deep breath, and, you know, there's all of this sort of energy going on in the room. And I said, you know what, let's talk about the issue. Let's not make it personal. And it just, all of a sudden, it just sucked all the oxygen out of the room because it named the behavior. I'm not even sure he understood what was happening there. But, of course, that was him tilting the playing field so that he could put me on the back foot and then, you know, make me, you know, own something that wasn't fair or whatever. So part of that interaction dynamic is being quite conscious. I think we're all really, really good at that. Our antenna are really high about what is the social sort of behavior that's going on here. And when somebody uses that in a way to put you off guard in order to get something, it's important to see it and then to kind of reset. And sometimes that reset is, wow, you just surprised me with asking me to give up my studio time because you have a higher priority. Let me think about that, as opposed to, oh, yeah, sure, okay, I can see you're really anxious. You know, that giving yourself time to negotiate in that kind of environment is really important, and also the ability to call out what is actually happening. So yeah, The Shadow Negotiation, I think it's an awesome book.
It's a lot of very good advice, because, I mean, it's really hard when you're getting very flustered just because of the moment. And that example that you gave really shows how you can diffuse a situation then you don't endanger your situation.
Yeah, your position. Yeah, it's called a turn. So just recognizing when you can introduce a turn to just kind of bring everything back to level.
Shadow Negotiations, that's very fascinating.
You know, I have this mantra. I actually have it taped next to my phone, and it's, people will forget what you said, and people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And I think about that a lot, particularly when I'm in a position of being a senior leader. It's, how do you leave with somebody a sense that they are great and they're better even than before the interaction you had with them? And, you know, I think that's part of our responsibility. And it's what people take away from that interaction long term, that, and they're lifted in that. I do think that's a role of leadership.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also, I guess, important to be able to be in those shoes, but not necessarily have to be that person or adapt their feelings or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a very important skill, I think, for smooth sailing in a world where, I mean, there's so many people out there these days that you really got to be able to communicate, I guess. I was reading this book, Sapiens, by Yuval Noah Harari. And he was talking about how the reason why so many people can be in one space at one time is because they believe in a collective idea. So they're thinking, for example, if you're in a cafeteria, oh, everyone is going to stay in this cafeteria and eat their food and study, and rather than if there were 1,000 chimps that were inside one small space, they would think, oh, there's food over there, I must grab and take away. So
there's like a collective, almost this invisible culture that happens when humans get together. Yeah.
Exactly. An agreement.
Yeah. Kind of a, what is the social harmony that knits us all together in this particular circumstance? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And I guess through that, we should be able to dig up the things that aren't actually thought as harmonious, but are thought to be that way. Mm-hmm. And so if these new conversations that are happening.
I think the solution to that is curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think that this sort of support for people actually going into listening at this point in our history, when we're talking about Me Too and Time's Up, how do we actually go into this deep listening mode where we're expressing curiosity, like, what is it like for you? And from that, we're going to get to solution then. And I think first we just have to sit in, I mean, I don't have that experience, so how am I going to just sit and be still and let that come from you so I can learn from that?
So I guess I feel really happy with what we've talked about.
Yeah,
just
great.
To wrap it up, there's one question. This is, I mean, a question that's been kind of in my head. And when I'm in an engineering situation, or like in a situation when I'm doing math or physics, sometimes I feel that I have to represent women because of the being a minority. Mm. And being like, okay, like, this is my time to back up the girls kind of thing. Do you ever get that feeling, or, and how would you deal with that feeling if you do?
That's a lot, isn't it, to feel that sense of responsibility and that weight. And in some ways that's extremely unfair to expect that you're like holding up the earth on your shoulders. I think we can do what we can when we have the energy to bring it. And no one expects that you're always out there as our warrior woman, changing everything around us. I think partly we need to have a lot of self-compassion. How do we bring energy at a time when we need it? And, you know, this analogy, and we talk about this in safety a lot, you have to put your own oxygen mask on before you put it on the person sitting next to you. I think that's really true, and it is true for us in the Women's March, when we're thinking about what are we doing in the moment right now to take care of our energy so that we can go out and be super present and to show what we feel, right, and be fierce. So, yeah, self-compassion, I think it does start with that, right, just the taking care of first.
Thank you very much. That was wonderful.
My pleasure, Julia. Thank you so much.
Right. So that was Catherine Room, once again, from Technical Safety BC.
Ever heard of Pitch Perfect? UBC A Cappella can sing on harmony in Q. Made up of 100 members across four choirs, the student-led club regularly performs on and off campus. Check out UBC A Cappella on Facebook for more information regarding their ACA Amazing end-of-term concerts.
We're back at UBC Happy Hour, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. Thank you for listening. This is Lillane.
Yeah, and this is Alex.
This is Amy.
Yeah, so thanks for listening tonight, everyone. We're going to end the show with our last interview with a really strong, awesome woman named Grace McDonald. And she spoke at a event this week called Queer Law 101, which was part of the Pride Week here at UBC with the UBC Pride Collective. So yeah, going with the theme of strong women, it was a really awesome episode, and we were really proud to bring it to you guys this week. So yeah, here is Grace McDonald with our last interview of the night, and good night, everyone.
So we are joined by Grace McDonald, who spoke at the Queer Law 101 event that was part of the Pride Week here at UBC. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So could you please briefly introduce yourself and your involvement with queer law in Canada?
For sure. So as you said, my name is Grace McDonald. And I'm currently a third-year law student at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, BC. I'm finishing up my law degree. I currently sit on the equity committee at our law school. I'm also an executive on the Women in Law Society, as well as being president of the Outlaws, which is our law school's LGBTQ advocacy group, which is kind of how I got my start in queer law. I'm also queer myself, so that kind of helps things. And I just kind of, these are personal issues that I take very seriously. I got interested through our club and eventually became president, which opened up a lot of doors into doing some really neat advocacy work with TRU law, as well as working with UBC and UVic law as well.
Awesome. You sound so accomplished. I love it. So you recently, as mentioned, you spoke at the Queer 101 Law event, which was part of Pride Week, which was hosted by the UBC Pride Collective. So maybe what is queer law? And maybe just if you could give us a quick overview of how queer law is part of the current state of law in Canada.
Right, so queer law has been around for quite some time, but more recently gained a lot of attention through a lot of high-profile cases, as well as a lot of great grassroots-based community activism, which I kind of have gotten involved with as well. But my presentation in terms of queer law in Canada was mostly focused on what has happened since gay marriage was legalized in 2005. It doesn't seem like 2005 was that long ago, but really there's been a lot that's happened recently. So I really focused on the most recent federal apology that the government made to LGBTQ individuals. And just more generally, queer law is essentially, in my perspective, achieving queer LGBTQ rights and just being treated as equal members of society, which some people may be surprised is actually still not the case in a lot of our communities, unfortunately. But I focused a lot on the federal apology that was given, the Trinity Western proposed law school case, Bill C-16 involving transgender rights. There was also recently a bill in Alberta, which now makes it illegal to for a high school to call the parents of a child who have joined a gay-straight alliance, as well as there's currently kind of a war against sexual orientation and gender identity groups that are trying to educate LGBTQ individuals in high schools, and that's occurring at a Chilliwack school trustee member. And then there's also a few things I discussed, including the ban against gay men donating blood, and then hopefully, sometime soon, a ban against gay conversion therapy.
Wow. Yeah, that's a really long list of things you covered. Yeah, but I don't know. It's really interesting because I think that sometimes, like here in Canada, especially, I think those of us who live in cities, I don't know, we might be kind of like under this illusion that, oh, we're so, you know, accepting and, you know, everything's like kumbaya. But there's so much happening that there's so much work that still needs to be done. As you kind of highlighted. So yeah, that's super interesting. And you mentioned the Trinity Western case, and yeah. I wanted to talk a bit about that, because I think that that's especially relevant to kind of the student population. So, yeah, could you maybe kind of touch on that case, the Trinity Western Law School case, and your role in that case?
Right. So Trinity Western is a private evangelical Christian school, which has a proposed law school. And essentially the issues that my coalition group, as well as many individuals have, is that they force their students to sign a mandatory community covenant, which among other things, such as you state that you will not get an abortion, you will not drink alcohol or consume drugs. It states that you can have no intimacy between same-sex couples. So, and then there's a few other things saying that there's no intimacy in the common law relationship, that it must be between a man and a woman, and they must be married. And it also, there's a footnote in there that actually goes to a Bible passage which says that homosexuality is vile. So there's a few issues in terms of if any LGBTQ students would ever want to attend a law school where they have to sign this mandatory covenant. So that's basically what the case is about. It pits religious freedoms against equality rights and the right to be free from discrimination.
Right. And so so what was your role kind of in this case or fighting against the case?
Yeah. So UBC Law, UVic Law, and my school, TRU Law, we banded together to form a coalition of law students. And they weren't just LGBTQ individuals. This was allies as well. And our position was essentially that, you know, studying the law, it's not about necessarily an evangelical Christian perspective, and that you should be able to study the law in a space where you feel safe and where you're able to fully be yourself. And so we're wholeheartedly against forcing students to sign a mandatory covenant. So we produced this, we have lawyers, and we produced this legal argument with the assistance of our lawyers. And the case kind of went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, so we actually got to travel to Ottawa to attend.
Wow. Was that like kind of a shining moment, or how did that feel being there?
It felt pretty incredible. There were some interesting things that happened leading up to it. The TRU Outlaws actually did a few phone calls with the federal government in terms of improving their relationship with LGBTQ individuals. So we actually got invited to attend the apology 2 days before the hearing in Ottawa. And that ended up with us meeting with the Prime Minister.
Whoa, okay. So what was the, outcome of the case?
So the case was heard on November 30th and December 1st, and the Supreme Court of Canada typically takes 4 to 6 months to write their judgment. So we're in the waiting period currently. So we won't get a judgment for a few more months.
Okay. Okay, wow. So is it kind of nerve-wracking, like waiting on that judgment?
It's nerve-wracking, but also just the advocacy work that we were able to do and the opportunity that we had to talk with so many individuals. And I know we're obviously hoping for one certain outcome, but just everything that's happened and the communications we've had and the friendships that we've built with other schools and even the government has just been, like, absolutely incredible. So it is nerve-wracking, but also it's been a time for us to reflect on how much of, a positive impact we've been able to have.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier Bill C-16. So I'm wondering if this case kind of relates to Bill C-16 at all, and maybe kind of like the interplay between these different subjects that you were talking about?
Right. So in most queer law cases, we're looking at advancing LGBTQ rights. So it definitely has a connection in terms of we're striking out the covenant. Hopefully we're protecting LGBTQ rights. And in terms of B-16, which actually amends the Canadian Human Rights Act to give gender identity and gender expression, it adds to the list of protected grounds, which kind of seems like we would already have that in the code, but unfortunately we don't yet. So we see this as just continuing to protect LGBTQ rights.
Yeah, awesome. And I'm wondering what kind of public reception you and your fellow legal activists got from this case, like with Trinity Western, because it was, you know, it's all over the media, and I'm wondering, you know, if was there like positive reception, negative reception? I imagine maybe some of both.
Yeah, I think that I've done a lot of media interviews, and I've faced a lot of internet trolls, unfortunately, and I tried as best I can to, like, ignore that, because for every, like, 10 negative comments or homophobic comments I receive on a weekly basis still, it just takes, honestly, one person to come up to me and just say thank you so much for fighting for my kids' rights. Like, I'm so tired being a mother and I'm unable to do so, but thank you so much for doing that. It recharges my batteries completely, and I just kind of forget about all the noise. So there are those kind of negative comments and debates on it, but the general reaction that we've had is incredibly positive, and I love taking, like, any amount of time out of my day to talk to people, and it is so important, like you said, and that people think we're all kumbaya, but people come to me and say, oh, like, sorry, this is a stupid question, or this is a really simple question I should know the answer to, and I never look at it that way. I think society is changing so much that you should feel safe about asking these questions because they're so incredibly important.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, questions lead to discussion and, like, learning, and I think that that's super important. And, yeah, having that open dialogue is so critical. Yeah, so I guess lastly, what advice would you give to other young activists based on your experiences?
I would say be persistent. It is, being an activist or being an advocate is a bit of a demanding job, and it's usually something you're doing for free, and it's a huge full-time job in its own right. So, but if it's something that you're passionate about, be persistent. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there, and rely on your community. There's a lot of people that you can look to or friendships that you can build. But also, I mean, through this, I've reached out to my member of parliament, Pamela Goldsmith-Jones, and she was wonderful in terms of support as well. But just, you know, be determined, be passionate, and talk to as many people as possible. And like we were just saying, even if they disagree with you, just listen to them and try to understand the argument and the points that they're bringing to the table too, because that's the only way we're going to kind of get things done, is if everybody's listened to and everybody has a seat at the table.
Amazing. Grace, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. And yeah, all the best with the rest of your work.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
Thank you.
Woo! Make some noise for Tristan Wheeler and Jack Lamming. CI on CITR Radio Pizza Party. What do you do?
Yeah.
What
now?
Make it louder.
Making louder.
Woo! I'm hungry. Let's start the show.
Hey.
Hey.
You're Hi. Listening to Radio Pizza Party.
Radio. I am. From CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from
the University of British Columbia on
unceded Musqueam territories.
Yeah, we are.
I am, of course, Tristan, the ashiest of Larrys, Clayton Wheeler.
Yeah.
I'm adding my middle name after the nickname.
Wait.